Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by endocrinologynetwork.com, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on endocrinologynetwork.com. Hello, and welcome to this edition of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with the wonderful Natalie Bellini. And this episode is special about our recap of EASD, in which we both attended virtually this year. The meeting was in Stockholm, Sweden. So there's so many things that happened there. We can't possibly share all of it, but we're going to share some of what we would consider our top highlights. We're going to start talking about the new ADA EASD treatment algorithm for type 2 diabetes. We're also going to talk about the weekly new results about the weekly insulin icodec. And then also there's some new real world data about some automated insulin delivery and smart pens. And then we have some really exciting announcements about CGM as well. So with that, let's go ahead. Let's dive right in. Natalie, I'm going to turn it over to you to kind of introduce everyone about this new treatment algorithm and maybe share what some of your key highlights or takeaways are from it.
Thanks, Diana. So the new treatment algorithm, which was published, and there are actually amazing slides online that you can download as a clinician for free, and we highly recommend it. We're not going to be able to touch on half, a third, 10% of what's really in there today, but we want you to download the slides and review them so that you feel comfortable as a clinician looking at them and discussing them, because this is the way we treat diabetes. So the first thing is the algorithm has been changed. In the past, they looked at hypoglycemia, cost, and weight as the three sort of guiding principles as to how we would do things. And now we're looking at efficacy and weight, because we can't always decide we still have to try to get the right thing through, right? Try to prescribe the right drug. And then if we can't, then we have to go back on the next thing. But we can't just say cost is everything. And it is, but it also shouldn't be. I think that helps us formulate, can I find a way to get, especially in the US, a patient assistance program, a copay card, is there a cheaper alternative to a class of medications? That's how I'm taking it. What do you think, Diana?
Yeah, I really like how it was basically simplified, and cost, of course, is important, as well as hypoglycemia is important, but that's important for everyone, right? It's not like you're only concerned about hypoglycemia for certain patients or only cost for certain ones. It's an issue for basically everyone. So now the algorithm is really split up into efficacy. Like, how efficacious is it? If you need 2% A1C lowering to get to the target, you would want the drug that is most effective at doing that. And then weight, because we know that the majority of people with type 2 diabetes also have overweight or obesity. And then what's really nice about it is it ranks them in a hierarchy. And so I think a lot of people are asking, because tirzepatide or Mounjaro came out since the last guideline was available, where does that kind of fit in? And so where that's in is actually, it's right next to semaglutide in terms of its efficacy for weight loss. So there's a very high tier, which is semaglutide and tirzepatide, and then high, which are the GLP-1s, dulaglutide and liraglutide. Intermediate, which includes other GLP-1 receptor agonists not already mentioned, as well as the SGLT2 inhibitors. And then neutral for weight are the DPP-4 inhibitors and then the metformin. So I like how it's very, very specific in terms of these are the drugs. If you're looking for weight, for weight reduction, these are the drugs that are going to help you do it.
Right. I agree. Absolutely. And it will help clinicians who are less familiar with the individual drugs to dial into what we're really trying to do, right? So I'm very pleased with the new, I think it's going to be as a person who teaches nurse practitioners, going to be really easy for me to help new learners learn how to do this better, right? And that's really what this guideline is supposed to be doing.
Right. And then on the side where it's for glycemic management, so specifically for A1C lowering or increasing time in range, for example, it talks about how metformin really is still considered first line or a combination with metformin plus another agent. And then it has the hierarchy of what would be considered kind of the very highest in terms of efficacy, which it labels as the dulaglutide, the high dose. So that's Trulicity, semaglutide or tirzepatide. And then below that insulin is also there as well, because we know insulin pretty much has unlimited A1C lowering, as well as combination with a GLP-1 and insulin. And then high would be a GLP-1 receptor agonist not already mentioned. So something like liraglutide or exenatide. And then an SGLT2 inhibitor, a sulfonylurea or a TZD. And then intermediate would be a DPP-4 inhibitor. So I think I think this is going to be very helpful because it's a little bit more prescriptive, I think, in terms of when do you use a certain agent. Versus in the previous algorithm, it was kind of like, okay, well, if you don't want hypoglycemia, you can use any of these four agents. If cost is an issue, use these. And you're kind of like, well, wait, they're all issues. And I don't want weight gain. So
what do I do next? Right. Absolutely. And I think, again, it will help guide people who do manage diabetes, not full time. Right. To really dial into what am I looking for to do? What's my number one goal? My number one goal is to blank, right? Sometimes for an older patient, it might be, I have to have no hypoglycemia, number one, right? Whereas other patients, we might say, and we'll tolerate weight neutral or some weight, but I need cardiovascular risk. Okay. Where does that fall into this? And it just helps you guide your clinical decision-making without spending, you know, again, we don't have that much time. Primary care does not have that much time to go, gee, I wonder what should be, you look at the list and you pick and you go, right? And hopefully it will help drive clinical decision and improve outcomes.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's the other part of the algorithm. Really the algorithm, I like to think of it as in kind of, I guess, two parts. So the part on the right with the weight and the efficacy is really if they're not major cardiovascular risk. If someone has high cardiovascular risk or has heart failure or chronic kidney disease, then the algorithm is very prescriptive in terms of the use of SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 receptor agonists. And that is irrespective of metformin use. So in these conditions, metformin is really not first line, although many times someone needs the A1C lowering that we will use the combination. So, and this is similar to how the algorithm was previously in terms of heart failure, SGLT2 inhibitors have the most benefit. For cardiovascular disease, it's GLP-1 receptor agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors. And then for kidney disease, SGLT2 inhibitors, Bermeni or GLP-1 receptor agonists. So that part's really similar, but there was one thing that was clarified a little bit that I find to be helpful. So if someone is high cardiovascular risk, we know also they would benefit from GLP-1s or SGLT2s, but that was kind of vague before. Like, what does that mean? How do you know if your patient is high risk? And so now it's actually clarified in the algorithm where it says, that for most, that could be a person that's over 55 that has two or more additional risk factors. So things like obesity, hypertension, smoking, dyslipidemia, or albuminuria. So that is, I think that's really helpful to clarify would be considered high risk.
So the other thing that I really, really appreciate in the new guidelines is their new approach to movement. There is a great slide, by the way, about, I don't know, what is it, 2/3 of the way through the deck that talks about movement and sitting. So they talk about sitting and breaking up prolonged sitting, sweating, moderate to vigorous activity, right? Strength training, strengthening, stepping, getting up and walking, right? As much as possible. And then also mentions sleep. And I love that it's an easy thing. I can print them and hand them to patients and talk a little bit about reducing cardiovascular risk by improving cardiovascular health, moving. We've got to get patients to move and really motivate them to move. So one of the stepping ones says an increase of just 500 steps a day, right? That's a short duration. It's not a whole lot of steps, right? Is associated with a 2-9% decrease of cardiovascular morbidity and all-cause mortality. I don't need a patient to add another 10,000, just start here, and really helping them set small goals to then create larger goals long-term. I love this. And I think we're going to use it a lot in patient care, in all of, you know, when they see the nutritionist, when they see the CDCES, when they see the nurse, when they see, and each of us can all bring that up together to improve their cardiovascular risk. I love it. Love it. Can't wait.
Yeah. So the diagram is so nice that is in these guidelines now. So it addresses the sitting, so incorporating more exercise, which it also has sweating. That's the second S. And then stepping is the third S, the 4 sleep, and then 5 strengthening. So yeah, it's great to see that is really, really emphasized. And then the other thing that we haven't mentioned yet in the algorithm, social determinants of health are actually at the top. Making sure that we address that is a big focus on that. And then also referring for diabetes self-management education and support. So lifestyle, behavior, positive behavior changes, all of those things are very much emphasized. It's not just about the drugs. Those things really all go hand in hand, as well as individualizing therapy and shared decision-making too. One more thing I just want to say about shared decision-making, because this was a different talk that I heard at EASD. And it was a talk about technology. Rich Bergenstahl was in there and Bill Polonsky, but Bill Polonsky made a comment about shared decision-making, that it's not just like we sit there with the patient and we just throw out all the options. And then it's like, all right, what should we do? What do you want to do? It's where we, as the clinician, we do impart our knowledge to provide a recommendation based on what we know about them and our specialized knowledge about the therapies. But of course, the patient is at the center of it and we're still letting them decide, but we are imparting our knowledge. It's not just like, I don't know, throw all the drugs
free
up
for
in the
all.
Air.
Right, exactly.
Like, eeny, right. Meeny, miny, mo.
Right. Here are the 6 choices. You pick which one you think is best. No, we're actually saying to the patient, you know, I'm concerned because of this, and this medication will help reduce your major adverse cardiac events, or this medication does this, or, you know, this, I want you to see, you know, we have patients don't want to necessarily see a dietitian, right? And I have to say to them, you're going to love her. I really think she's not going to judge, you know, and you're really trying to get them to agree without pushing them to say, you cannot see me unless you go to see the dietitian. That's not true. You can see me anyway, but you'll do better if you do. You're not just one time, right? You're sort of pushing your own wants and needs for that patient because you know it will improve their outcomes. If you'll try one time, we'll never talk about it again. And then they come back and say, I loved her, right? That's the whole idea, right? Is that you do know because you do have this knowledge and you're trying to help them help themselves, right? That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. So these guidelines will actually also be in the ADA standards of care. So they were published simultaneously in diabetes care and diabetologia, but they will be in the standards in the section 9. So kind of stay tuned for that. That's exciting.
Coming soon in December, right? Yeah.
Right. In December when those guidelines come out. So I want to talk about a couple other things that happen at EASD. One of them is related to that insulin ICOTAC, which is the weekly insulin. And so there was, let me just pull this up. So there was new data that was published. So it's the ONWARDS program, and this is a phase 3 program. So previously we saw results from phase 2, and now we've got a readout from ONWARDS 2. And this was a trial that included 562 people over 26 weeks that basically investigated the effect of insulin ICOTAC, the weekly insulin, compared to insulin degludec, the brand name is Tresiba, and looked at outcomes. The primary outcome was change in A1C. Secondary outcomes were time in range, body weight, and insulin dose. And I'm really happy to see that patients wore CGM and we have time in range data. That's awesome. And the patients were on basal insulin. They were not on bolus, and the baseline characteristics were similar between groups. They were, a lot of them were taking metformin, 30% were on SGLT2 inhibitors, 25% were on GLP-1 receptor agonists. And kind of bottom line was that insulin icodec conferred a 0.9% reduction in A1C, while insulin degludec had a 0.7% reduction. So, and that was statistically significant, the difference. And 40% of participants on insulin icodec achieved an A1C of less than 7% compared to 26.5% on insulin degludec. And then addition to that, 63% on icodec had, on insulin icodec, 63% time in range, that 70 to 180 compared to 60% on insulin degludec, which is a difference of 42 minutes per day, although that was not statistically significant. So sorry, I know that was a lot of data, but exciting to see these outcomes reported. And Natalie, I'm curious your thoughts on this weekly insulin. And also, do you think this has a place for any of your patients?
Oh, I love this idea. So, you know, we all have patients that you just wonder, right? What's happening? What's going on? Our elderly patients, can you imagine having a parent that needs insulin? And do they remember it? Do they not remember it? Is it happening or not? When once a week, you could just go and give it, right? You're guaranteed, this person needs insulin, and we're just concerned that they are getting it or not. I also see it in and obviously it's not approved for pediatrics or anybody yet, but like, think about the pediatric population where some of those kids, I mean, I come from a pediatric background, and we would try to give degludec on a Friday afternoon for those kids going home and not getting insulin over the weekend. And then again on Monday, hoping that we could keep them out of DK. This all goes away, right? We can guarantee the insulin injection and then it's done, right? I think it has a huge potential for a lot of our patients. And then for patients who don't struggle even, think about this, right? Why do we use a weekly GLP-1 versus a daily? It's easier. It's less burden, right? So you get it once a week and it's done. I love the idea. And I think I have a lot of patients, you know, you and I both do lots and lots of technology, but a lot of our patients choose not to pump, right? They choose not to. They'd rather do injections. They don't want things on their bodies. They don't, you know, this could be the answer for a lot of them. It really could.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it because one of the other outcomes was they just reported patient satisfaction, quality of life, which was higher in the icodec group, probably because one injection a week is a lot nicer than seven injections a week. So that is great to see. I think some questions still remain. So the hypoglycemia was a little bit higher in the icodec group, although it wasn't statistically significant. So that's good to see because that's been kind of one of the concerns. But some of the additional questions that kind of remain are just like the dosing strategy. So in this trial, they increased by 20 units at a time. Because remember, it's once a week. You're getting your whole dose once a week instead of spread out over the 7 days. Right. So that's, you know, that's something to kind of to kind of keep in mind. So they were recommending, the presenters were kind of saying, in terms of patient candidates, probably people that are a little bit more stable, that are not experiencing tons of hypoglycemia, that have kind of more standard routines, maybe at least better to start this often. But I also think about how we were nervous about degludec and glargine U300 when those first came out, because those have longer half-lives, and we're like, oh no, they're going to have more hypoglycemia, and like, it's going to be harder to change the dose. But in the end, we found that they had less hypoglycemia. So I kind of feel like if we're careful with the titration, if we slowly increase the doses, that hopefully we'll see that there won't be more hypoglycemia. And another thing in this trial is the doses in the icodec group were actually higher. They were slightly higher than the other group. It ended up being 268 units a week compared to 244 units a week. So it's like, that can be a reason why there was a little bit more hypoglycemia also. So I think, you know, probably some questions remain in terms of the perfect dosing strategy, but hopefully we'll see this submitted to the FDA soon and be another therapeutic option for our patients.
Absolutely. And I think we need to remember, when you go up by 20 units in a once weekly insulin, it's less than 3 units a day, right? So we have to think about it differently, right? So you know, I think there's a lot to learn still, but I'm very excited for those patients that want something with less burden or that need help.
For sure. And actually, that's how they adjusted the degludec in the trial. They did 3 units per day. Right. So it was very, very,
very similar right.
Yep. To that. And also, like, in terms of the future, combining this with one of the weekly GLP-1 agonists,
imagine.
You just think of the power right. of that. Yeah, it could be someone would just take one medicine once a week for their type 2 diabetes. I mean, that's amazing. So it's so cool to see how far we've come. So yeah,
absolutely. Right.
Great to see that. So we should end up hearing from the other trials in that program in the future. So another area I want to talk about too is just some of the real world data that came out. So we've been hearing about this for a while, like with the Medtronic 780G, how well it's been performing in other countries. It is not FDA approved in the United States, but it's been around in other countries since 2020. So we have a ton of real world data. And one of the things that came out that they Bob Vigersky actually presented was how well the data looks for older patients. So they specifically split it up into people over 56 years, and not that every person that's 56 is an older person, but that's how they they split it up. But they showed it was really amazing in terms of how well that population did. So 81% of older adults were able to achieve a time in range of 70% or higher, which was actually compared to 68% in the 16 to 55. And this is real world data. So this isn't like the cherry picked people in the clinical trials who are just so excited about everything and completely follow directions 100%. This is like real world, real world. But one of the interesting things Bob Vigersky said is like, do we need to reevaluate the time and range guidelines? So the International Consensus on Time and Range put out their guidelines in 2019. Which says for older adults, the goal for time and range is 50% or more. And with so many people being able to reach the 70% or higher, do we need to rethink that? Like, is 50%, are we aiming too low? What do you think, Natalie?
I think he really is got something going there, right? If someone's on MDI, because we need to avoid hypoglycemia with the older adult, right? That's really the goal, is that there's as close to zero as possible. So, you know, we tolerate those higher numbers in order to not end up having someone trip and fall from a low blood sugar and break a hip, right? So the idea that we could actually, do we change the goal if someone's on an AID system? Is that a different goal that we could have for those patients? I know that I've had patients on AID who are older, and I say, well, we're not doing, 50% is not enough for you. We can do better. And so I think he's opened up a wonderful place to discuss. Wow, we really can get really much more tight control. And, you know, especially for someone who is in their later 50s, they've got a long life to live, right? We're not, you know, that's different than a 75-year-old, right? So especially, you know, I mean, maybe we have to look at them differently in an age kind of way, right? Is a 70 plus a different number than a, right? And I do believe though that the AID systems should be driving some of our older patients to lower, to increase their time and range goals.
Yeah, I mean, it's so remarkable because they split it out by country and it's like they're all averaging in the high 70%,
right.
Like for all the country. And that's the total data. Then when you look at like the over 56, it's even higher. A lot of them were in the 80%, like easily in the 80s. So it is interesting. The other thing that they also presented there was the InPen data. So that's the real world InPen data. That's the connected pen, which I love using in my patients. Unfortunately, that data does not look as good. So it's not 70-80%. What they did was they shared data from, I think it was 780 people using InPen, and showed that for type 1 diabetes, the average time in range was very close to 50%. And then for, and that was all people with type 1 diabetes. For CGM users, it was 56.8%. So it was a little bit higher. And interestingly, for the ones that were over 65, it's actually 60%. So it was higher, but unfortunately, it wasn't as good as those on the 780G. So it's kind of interesting because I'm sure that's better than people just on MDI and just on like a regular vial and syringe or regular pen. But the outcomes, unfortunately, that we're seeing so far with connected pens aren't as good as we see with automated insulin delivery.
Which makes sense though, right? I mean, if you think about it, when you can see that when the sensor looks at that speed and directional arrow and then makes changes to the background insulin based on that, I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where those numbers are going to be as good, right? I just don't. So, but that's impressive data still, right? And I guess the other thing I hope that at some point they'll present on is the disease burden that goes with using a smart pen.
Yeah. And I just want to clarify, actually, the type 1 diabetes was over 15,000 users, the average of 50%. It was those over 65, that is 780, that had a 60% time in range. But across all the groups, the hypoglycemia was well below the 4% thresholds. So that, I guess that part is good. And one of the things I've seen with previous InPen data is that a lot of times patients are not optimized on their long-acting insulin. So with the way InPen works is it's just working with the rapid-acting, the mealtime insulin. So someone's still taking their daily long-acting insulin, maybe in the future a weekly long-acting insulin, but right now a daily. And so the reports will show if glucose is rising or falling overnight. And a lot of these reports show that there's a rise or that there's too much of a fall. Someone's having hypoglycemia, overtreating it, then waking up high. And so if someone's not optimized on their long acting, they're not going, it doesn't matter how great their tool is during the day, they're not going to reach goal. So I feel like it's not the fault of the connected pen. I think there probably needs to be some more education around dose titration. And we'll hopefully see that in the future because there's companies like DreamMed and other companies that are working on software to automate this process and advise clinicians like this is how you should increase it. And so I think that will address some of the therapeutic inertia and hopefully increase time in range for people that are on these devices and not on AID systems. So I know we've talked about so many things today, but there's one more thing I want to talk about, and that's just with some of the excitement with CGM. So this is not EASD, but recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was an article about Flash CGM in type 1 diabetes. This is a randomized control trial, and this was done with the Libre 2 system. And you might be thinking, well, duh, doesn't CGM improve outcomes? Doesn't it improve A1C and time and range? Well, it does. We know that, but unfortunately with the Libre, the original trial that was done with the original system that did not have alerts, it was designed to show that it reduced hypoglycemia. So that was actually the impact trial. And it indeed showed that. Mm-hmm. But when you look at like the standards of care, flash CGM or intermittently scanned CGM gets a lower grade because it didn't have as many of the outcomes in randomized controlled trials with A1C lowering. So this trial really officially answers that question. And the fact that it's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think speaks volume about it's a very well-designed trial. And just to give a quick recap, it was 156 participants randomized one-to-one to the CGM or to finger sticks. And the primary outcome was change in A1C, and it showed that A1C did indeed decrease. So the mean A1C level was 8.7% in the CGM group, 8.5 in the usual care group, and decreased to 7.9 in the CGM group and 8.3 in the usual care. So that was a difference of 0.5%, and similar to what we've seen with like the real-time CGM data. So that was pretty big. And Natalie, you want to share some of the big news we've heard recently about Libre 3.
So our practice was one of the practices that was in the early adopter for Libre 3 program, and you had to order them through a distributor, which ultimately meant more paperwork for everyone. And now, as of this week, you can order Libre 3 at the regular pharmacy. So you can send it anywhere and they are able to fill them. They've taken the last handful of months to stock everyone, basically. So we're extremely excited, because what is the difference between the 2 and the 3? The first biggest difference is that there is no more scanning. We're done with intermittently scanning, and then beautiful thing is, if you put it on a patient and they don't get near their phone again for 14 days, it still holds all the data. So if something odd happens, but most patients are on their phones lots, I don't think it's going to be an issue. But so you don't have to be on top of it at all. And that's really wonderful. The second biggest thing is that it's smaller. And instead of the size of 2 quarters, we're now looking at the size of 2 stacked pennies. And patients that we've put on it have loved the size difference. So we're very excited about that. And then the final thing that we really want to talk about today is the international launch of the Dexcom G7. So it is not available as of today in the US. So everybody take a big deep breath, but it has had a pretty big international launch, right? And that's exciting. It's a real challenge to launch in more than one country at a time. And how many were there? 6, 7 countries that it launched in all at the same time. So we're excited to see their data, and we're really excited to, we're looking forward to the launch of G7, hopefully in the near future in the US.
Yeah, you know, very, very exciting that it is expanding worldwide. And also what we got an announcement this past week too, or at EASD during EASD about the Tempo button with Lilly. So that's the connected pen cap. So speaking of smart pens, that was FDA approved. So we will hopefully see that launching in the near future. And that's really exciting, because then we would have a third connected pen or pen cap option in the US. Currently we have Bigfoot Unity, and we have Medtronic's InPen. So lots of exciting things. And then one more thing that I just saw is very hot off the press about CGM is that Medicare, so CMS, has developed draft guidelines for CGM, where they're talking about expanding use to people with type 2 diabetes on basal insulin only. That would be huge. If you guys all recall, about a little over a year ago, they removed that horrible 4 times a day finger stick requirement. And that was great. It really expanded use for more patients. And now that they're considering this is really, really exciting. So it's actually open for public comment. Encourage a lot of advocacy, because I'm definitely in favor of this. That's just so much excitement in this space.
They would change the way we practice. That's what that would do, right? It really would. We use a lot of diagnostic sensors on patients who use basal only. And this would allow patients to actually use them. I think it's an amazing tool, right? You give someone basal insulin and say to them, go exercise or go do this, and they're afraid to, right? Or they're falling overnight and they don't see it. This is very exciting and needed. It really is needed.
Yeah. So we've talked about a lot of things today, and I feel like there's so much more I want to talk about, but we got to give our listeners a rest and not get tired of us. So next episode, there's also things we did not get to talk about today. ADA and KDIGO came out with a new type 2 diabetes guideline in kidney disease, which is also really exciting. There's some big, big things there. And then also there was another guideline about AID, automated insulin delivery, with the ADA and EASD. So we're going to talk about that next time. But for now, we're going to go. Thank you so much for listening today.